It may please the court, I'm Alan Milstein. I represent Brandon Austin. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. So I'm going to argue the Title IX issues. My colleague, Mr. Michaels, will argue the 1983 issues for the last 3 minutes. So at first glance, the question is, are you going to adopt or have you already adopted the McDonnell-Douglas standard? And I think you've already have, even though the university is arguing that you haven't. If you look at the case that we cited, you've certainly used that standard in the summary judgment context. There's no reason to think you wouldn't use it in the 12B6 context.
Well, I think there is a reason. Of course, if you go back to the history of McDonnell-Douglas, it was in the summary judgment context in a Title VII case. But the Supreme Court in Sierkiewicz, assuming that's how you pronounce it, they basically said that they rejected McDonnell-Douglas at the pleading stage. So I'm interested to know how you square that statement with your effort to adopt it at the pleading stage.
Well, after that Supreme Court case, you had the Doe versus Columbia case.
Right, that's a Second Circuit case.
In the Second Circuit.
And the way the Second Circuit construes it, I think, may be just wrong. So let's say you don't have the Second Circuit case, and of course we're not bound by the Second Circuit. In your view, how can you square the clear statement in Sierkiewicz with the standard that you are now trying to adopt?
Well, I mean, I think in Imeldi you essentially adopted the same standard as Doe versus Columbia. But the reason I said at first glance is because I don't think it matters.
Well, that's another question, of course. It might not matter because you could get to the same result in your view or in the defendant's view.
Right.
I guess each side thinks it doesn't matter.
So the difference is whether it's minimal plausibility or plausibility. And I think under either, if you look at the Baum case in the Sixth Circuit, which I think, along with the Columbia case, those are the two closest cases to this one. In the Baum case, you had a situation where the accused did not have the right to cross-examination, did not get a list of the witnesses, and the court essentially said that the lack of cross-examination, to not have the right to cross-examine witnesses itself, essentially proved the erroneous factor that had to be proven in order to succeed on Title IX. And in addition, in the Baum case, because you need not only to show an articulated doubt as to the accuracy of the result, you need to have it tied to gender bias. And also in the Baum case, in that Sixth Circuit case, it said that where you've got a situation at the University of Michigan where that case took place, where you've got protests and the public essentially pressuring the university to, in essence, kick out these guys who've been accused, that's gender bias. So you've got the combination of no cross-examination, and you have the combination of this, in essence, trying not to aggravate the protest. And as the court said in Doe versus Columbia, it's certainly plausible that when you've got those kinds of protests, that the board, the hearing board, is going to want to not essentially fan the flames of those protests. And again, as said in Doe versus Columbia and in the other cases, it doesn't matter whether that is the best, most plausible reason for the board doing what it did. It only has to be a plausible reason.
Would you explain... in your view, the difference between this conference administrative proceeding and the panel hearing, and what, in your view, your clients gave up by not going to a panel hearing and vice versa?
It was a distinction without a difference. In essence, it was a Hobson's choice given to Mr. Austin's attorney. You could have a panel conference or you could have the administrative conference, but in neither case are you going to have the right to cross-examine. In neither case are you going to have the right to call witnesses. And so counsel said, well, you know, between the two of them, what difference does it make?
Well, you had your client had the right to respond to the charges, to request that people of their choosing be contacted for information, had the right to counsel. There was a hearing officer present.
But no right to cross-examination.
Is that, in your view, required under Matthews' analysis for every due process hearing in this context?
Not for every due process hearing. So when you have competing narratives, that is, all you have is a he said versus she said, with no other witnesses able to, in essence, say, I heard that or I heard this. In that case, as Baum said, then you need to have the cross-examination. There are
I need to clarify a factual question then with regard to the he said, she said. The ultimate conclusion was, as I understand it, only that express consent is required and implied consent isn't good enough under the policies of the university. And I did not understand your clients to be arguing that they had received express consent as distinct from implied consent. So where is the factual dispute that would have, in your view, demanded cross-examination?
What we allege in our complaint and what is in the student brochure and what is present in other cases is you need either verbal consent or unmistakable physical indication of consent. Either or, and we pled both. And again, the court has to take everything that we pled and infer that is correct.
You know, it doesn't have to be verbal consent.
It doesn't have to be verbal. So what happened in this case, as happened in some of the other cases, the woman voluntarily goes into the cab. The woman voluntarily goes to the apartment. The woman, as happened in the Columbia case, she takes off her clothes. So there were, we allege that it was verbal consent or, we said. So if there was testimony in discovery, I believe our clients will say, to some extent, there was verbal consent, but there also was unmistakable physical indication of consent.
Just to be clear, my read of it is that what you alleged in your complaint is the verbatim definition of consent from the university's policies. Do I have that right?
That's correct. Which included, again, that line that it's unmistakable physical indication of consent, that's enough. Now, again, there are two theories. One is erroneous outcome, and we believe it's hard for me to understand how the judge could say that we did not adequately plead that there was an erroneous outcome. If you look at the paragraphs of the complaint, we pled it in detail. But there's a second theory with respect to Title IX, and that's the selective enforcement theory. The judge totally ignored that theory. So the selective enforcement theory says if either in the initiation or in the penalty there is gender bias, then that also states a claim under Title IX. So in this
way, where is the allegation of similarly situated students or situations?
I understand what you mean by similarly situated.
Well, when you talk about selective enforcement, then that's what you're talking about, is you're talking about comparisons of similarly situated situations and the government, or in this case the university, does not treat them similar, and that's why you have selective enforcement.
Right.
I'm looking for the allegation that shows that similarly situated students were treated differently based on the outcome in some way.
So what we alleged is essentially, and what happened in this case is that they said to counsel.
Okay, well, let's first start not with what you're saying and what they said, but tell me where in the complaint I look for that fundamental allegation that really lays out the selective enforcement claim, the treating the different groups differently.
Well, we said it was that what he was essentially sentenced to was 4 to 10 years, and that in none of the other cases was 4 to 10 years on the table or imposed.
But how does that relate to a gender-based discrimination?
Well, I'll get to that. So
okay. Well, so it's selective. Just tell us straight up, because I'm missing your allegation.
Want to talk about due process. So yeah. If you could.
But I want to hear why.
The gender base has to do with the fact that in every one of these cases, the males, and we have affidavits from the attorneys saying that the males were always convicted essentially by the university. In the one case in which there was the attorney said he had a woman client, she was not convicted. You had these protests going on, and you had the college president giving a speech with code words.
But I'm really having trouble tying that up with your selective enforcement. So just tell me in short order, what's the bottom line on selective enforcement, just so I understand your theory?
If you look in our complaint, paragraphs 30 to 52, which I think is 148
to
150.
You're looking at the amended complaint?
Third amended complaint, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Which
Thank
is
you.
148 to 155 in the record. We allege that as a result of all the, again, this is in the initial pleading stage where everything's got to be construed in our favor. We allege that these protests, the speeches by the president, all essentially embody exactly what the other courts say is gender bias. It can be construed no other way, but at least it's plausible.
Counsel, you have eaten into your colleague's time, so we'll hear from him next. Although you do have the 3 minutes that he promised us from you, so.
I was going to ask about that. I see we have our 3 minutes for
yes,
rebuttal.
Yes, go.
I'll keep going. Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Brian Michaels. I represent Mr. Artis and Mr. Dotson. What I want to start with is not so much a legal analysis, but just a factual underlying. And I want to discuss the factual presentation by attorney Greg Verrilroot.
Could I ask my question? Would you mind terribly if you're talking about due process? Because you have very little time. And
I would
really like to talk about the liberty interest and the reputational interest,
yes,
which seem to have been given very short shrift here. Do you have an argument? Are you making an argument under the due process clause that your client had a protected reputational interest?
Yes. And we have that at Goss, which is a 1975 U.S. Supreme Court case, and Marin, which is 1974, that talks about the nature of one's good name, the nature of one's subject to government action.
Okay, you've answered my question.
Okay. Now, what I want to do about Mr. Verrill, and I'm blind in one eye, so I have to turn.
It's fine.
No problem.
Mr. Verrill's declaration presents the facts of the university's own investigative report. Now, bear in mind, we are at the stage where we're merely trying to break down the doors of discovery. But as his client, as he represented his client, he was not allowed to take with him the investigative report done by the university, but he was allowed to read it. And in his declaration, he swears that as he reads this report, he believes that their investigation exonerates, that it exculpates these students, and that he was surprised that there was any discipline because their investigation supports the student's own story. Now, we don't have this report, but if the university's own investigation plausibly exonerates and exculpates these students, we need to see that report. Because that would undermine any defense by these defendants of a title of gender, no gender discrimination, there was due process, and of course qualified immunity. Because anybody would know that if you're an investigator, and your own investigation exonerates the person you're accusing of a crime, then you should not pursue a criminal action against that person. or a disciplinary action.
Say
in this
there
case.
Wasn't a criminal action by these defendants.
A disciplinary action. I'm sorry. I said criminal. I got a little carried away there. But, you know, why would they pursue a disciplinary action against a man when their own investigation says that they didn't do what the woman says she said to do? Again, these are at the pleading stages. We must take Mr. Verrill Rood's declaration on its face as true. He did not receive a copy of this report because he wasn't allowed to by the university. So we think that, you know, with little time I have, that was the highlight point I could make on all issues at once. If there's a report by the university that exonerates and exculpates these students, then by all means, we need to open the doors of discovery on all of these constitutional issues of whether there was due process, whether there was gender discrimination, and, of course, qualified immunity. And I appreciate you allowing me to take these moments. And if you have any questions, I'm certainly available at this time.
I don't believe we do. And since we did ask a lot of questions, one of you may have 2 minutes for rebuttal when the time comes.
Thank you very much.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Kevin Reed. I'm vice president and general counsel for the University of Oregon, here to argue for appellees. Title IX. Your Honors.
Could we talk about due process?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
I'd really like to know why the position is. I don't think there's a strong argument here at all about a protected property interest. So just to focus your attention, I'm concerned about a liberty interest and why these folks don't have a reputational interest.
We think that matter was fully resolved in Paul versus Davis, Your Honor, in which the court said that without finding the property interest, which does not exist.
I'm not talking about a property interest. I'm talking about a liberty interest.
I fully understand.
Forgive me. All right, I'll listen.
The court did hold that one could not pursue a liberty interest without showing an underlying violation of a property right as well. That's Paul versus Davis, that there's no liberty without a property right. And that makes sense, Your Honor. Otherwise, every defamation by a public official could blossom into a title.
No, that's not the Supreme Court's authority in this area. There are other instances where the court has made very clear that you have to do a lot more. The government would have to do a lot more than defame someone, and it's not enough to just fire someone. But there are admittedly outlier cases, but cases where the government has taken action, for example, labeling somebody a communist, something really vile, really defamation per se,
sure,
where that has been deemed sufficient. Why isn't that sufficient here?
Because
in this day
and
age, because these folks are being accused of sexual assault?
They were accused of a violation of the Student Conduct Code, which is having sex, penetrative sex, without consent. Nobody at the university accused them of rape. Nobody at the university called it sexual assault.
Is it really your position that this isn't something that would have been akin to a deep stain or badge of infamy? Really?
No, Your Honor. This was obviously a very serious matter for the university.
Right, very serious, all the way around. So it's just a question of whether they have a protected interest to get to the question, to even get to the question about whether there was adequate process.
Fair point, Your Honor. And they did have adequate process. That's my first.
And it's not about adequate process. I'm trying to figure out why your position is that they didn't have a protected interest at all.
Because we believe that Paul versus Davis says that there needs to be a property interest. And
all right,
the state of Oregon, and that interest, those interests that need to be protected by due process are established by state law. And we don't believe that there's a state law that established an interest that entitled them to due process and certainly didn't entitle them to more process than they actually received. My first argument is that they did receive due process, Your Honor.
Are you linking, then, the reputational interest to the liberty interest?
Yes, Your Honor.
As opposed to a separate interest?
Yes, Your Honor. No, I believe that they are. I believe that that is the argument as pled in the Fourth Amendment, in the Third Amendment complaint.
You're saying it needs a foundation, like in the federal employment cases, you need the right to employment, and then you can also have a right to reputational harm.
Exactly, Your Honor.
And you're just saying, in your view, there is no foundational right.
There's no foundational right to the liberty interest because there is no foundational property interest as established by the state of Oregon, as found and certainly has not been clearly established as the district court found when he granted qualified immunity.
And this last point you're making really goes to qualified immunity, which is, again, a separate point.
Yes, Your Honor. The more fundamental point is they did get due process. Due process requires a fair opportunity to be heard, to understand the allegations that are being made against you, and an opportunity to present evidence. They had all of those things.
Is there any case that is similar to this that you're aware of that squarely holds that cross-examination is not a required element of a due process hearing?
I'm unaware of a case that holds that cross-examination, squarely holds that cross-examination is not required, is not an element. That said, there's only one case that would establish that it is, and that is Baum, which I would argue is not necessarily correctly decided, but certainly was decided on the facts of that case, in which it was a word-against-word allegation that was dispositive in that case, as the court found. There is certainly no clearly established right in the circuit or in the state of Oregon to cross-examination in these contexts, and it happens regularly in university processes across the country.
I'm not quite sure why this word-against-word distinction matters here, because as I understand the student's argument, they're basing it on the or clause of the student misconduct rules, and that is, or something that is unmistakable. Sure. Conduct. So sure. In some ways, if the conduct is not disputed so much as like, if this and this happened, which they allege, then are you just saying as a matter of law that's not unmistakable conduct, or that it is unmistakable conduct? I mean, is it decided almost like a matter of law? Or, in their view, they still have a he said, she said.
Your Honor, no. My argument is that Mr. Weintraub, when he sat as the tribunal in the administrative conference, had sufficient evidence in front of him to find a violation of the student conduct code, without necessarily resolving the dispute between what the female student said and what these respondents in the case said. Because,
and that's how you would distinguish it from Baum in some respect?
Absolutely, Your Honor, because the confessions of the students themselves in the surreptitious recordings and text messages with the female student, as well as what they said to the police, was enough for Mr. Weintraub. Mr. Dotson.
But to decide what? To decide that there hadn't been any conduct that was unmistakable?
Yes, that there was not explicit consent for the conduct that was engaged in. Consent could be withdrawn at any time, Your Honor. Mr. Dotson, in his statement to the police, confesses that after the first encounter in the bathroom, when the female student went in the hallway, she was crying. And yet, he brought her back into the bathroom with two of his friends to engage in some, you know, very troubling conduct. And when she cried later, then yes, he does state that they stopped at that point. But those facts, combined with the statements from the young men themselves, they understood why she was upset. They understand why she would feel that she was taken advantage of.
So is it the university's position that these conflicting facts, which are very troubling facts, and no one is minimizing them, but we're just trying to get our arms around this, it's a 12B6, so trying to get our arms around how this can be decided as a matter of law when there's this very conflicting evidence, given the definition of consent that's in the university policy. And it sounds like now what you're arguing is that even if consent was given, it was with, or if it could have been understood by unmistakable conduct, that it was then withdrawn? Is that it?
Yes, with one caveat, Your Honor. I'm saying that is what Mr. Weintraub found, and it was well within his prerogative. He didn't abuse it. He didn't engage in an erroneous outcome. But the real question you're asking is...
Did he find that it was withdrawn?
He found that they violated... There's no specific factual finding in his decision. What he did find is that they did not have explicit consent for the penetrative sexual conduct that they engaged in.
Right, but I don't think he referred, forgive me, I don't think he referred to this definition, which is a peculiar definition, and it's an either-or. It allows for this unmistakable conduct, and that it sounds like your answer is we don't have that.
I believe Mr. Weintraub did have enough to make the decision he did. My real argument, Your Honor, is that the district court was not there to retry that case. The question before the district court on the Rule 12 motion was, did these individuals have due process? Did they have an opportunity to understand the charges?
I have one sort of follow-on question, I think, to both of my colleagues' questions. I'm trying to just pinpoint the your argument concerning cross-examination seems to me to be twofold. The first is it's not necessarily required, and second, it isn't required in the circumstances because the decision concerning discipline rested on the plaintiff's own account of events. Is that your position?
Yes, Your Honor, that is a position. I would add to that, very importantly, that ultimately the due process claims, the Section 1983 claims, lie only against the individually named defendants in this case. The 11th Amendment precluded those claims to be brought against the university, which means that qualified immunity becomes the dispositive issue here.
In the due process arena, would you just explain on behalf of the university what is the difference between this administrative conference
Absolutely.
And the panel hearing?
Absolutely, and they're very similar. And it was the choice that they made, as advised by counsel, to go for the administrative conference. So what did they have that was, in fact, due process? They had a right to see the record, which they did. Mr. Villarude's declaration says that. Now, he wasn't allowed a copy out of the room, but he was allowed to make notes and see it and see what was in there. They were allowed, the plaintiffs below had rights to counsel. They had the rights to an impartial decision maker. They had the rights to present a response. They had a right to present supplemental material, which Mr. Villarude's declaration says they did. And so one of the fundamental claims is, well, Mr. Weintraub didn't subpoena the taxi driver. Well, the taxi driver could have been subpoenaed had they chosen to go with the panel hearing approach. On advice of counsel, they chose not to do that.
So maybe you're mixing and matching what happened with the procedural aspects. What's the fundamental difference? I know one big difference, of course, is one counsel pointed out, is they felt they were in a Hobson's choice in terms of the expulsion situation. But what do you get in a panel hearing?
What you get in a panel hearing is all of the above that I just described, plus the right to call and examine witnesses, the right to have the Office of General Counsel issue subpoenas, to have those witnesses attend, and the right to an appeal. I'm saying that it really
wasn't... Is cross-examination provided in the panel hearing?
Yes, Your Honor, it is.
Okay.
And where do we look on the record to see what the panel hearing gives you, or is it in the state administrative procedures or the university procedures?
So it is not within the record, Your Honor, but it is judicially noticeable in the Oregon administrative rules. Actually, the former Oregon administrative rules were in effect in 2014. OAR 571-021-41.
Thank you.
Counsel, what's it mean that the district court's observation that each player, quote, benefited the full promised year of their scholarship? So I don't need to talk about the renewable portion of the scholarship,
sure.
But what about the credits they had been awarded for that quarter where this incident occurred?
The scholarship awarded, you know, allowed them the cost of tuition and the full cost of attendance, which is a stipend to cover their rent. They're given food at the training table. They enjoyed all of those benefits through the end of the school year.
Okay, so it was never terminated?
Correct.
But for that year.
Wait a minute. This happened in March, right?
The incident happened March 9th, the early morning hours. The administrative conference, I believe, happened in May.
They didn't finish that school year?
My understanding, and the record is not entirely clear on this, Your Honor, the students themselves voluntarily left the university at some point in March or April after their basketball season was over. That was not the university's determination. We just certainly didn't recoup from them their tuition. We certainly would have continued to allow them to go to the training table, with the exception of Mr. Austin, who was still under, because he didn't present himself to a hearing on the ETS, he was under a temporary suspension that did restrict some of his activities. But in terms of the scholarship, the food, the lodging, the tuition was still covered.
But they weren't allowed to finish out the term and earn those credits?
They absolutely were allowed.
Wait, I misunderstood. What about Mr. Austin? He was not allowed? He was under a suspension?
He was under an emergency temporary suspension. The record is not entirely clear about exactly what those constraints were. It's a typical process in any Title IX proceeding in which one puts some restrictions on
I'm just trying to figure out whether he was allowed to take those exams and earn those credits.
It's somewhat of a moot point, Your Honor. He left town and never came back. It was not our choice. It was his choice.
Where is that in the record?
It is not in the record, Your Honor. It was not material. It's not what they pled. The issue was whether they got...
Well, they sure did. They pled they had a property interest, and the sentence is, I think, awkward because they talk about a renewable scholarship interest, and the future years, I think, is not of interest to me.
Right.
But the credits that had been awarded to them pursuant to which they were, you know, studying at the time of this incident is interesting to me. And I think they sure did plead that.
Yes, Your Honor. They were allowed to continue their school year. They certainly had
except for Mr. Austin.
Which he could have appealed that emergency temporary suspension. And I would be happy to produce a supplemental briefing on that issue, Your Honor, since the record is not clear about whether these individuals were allowed to continue.
Well, we're here on the pleadings, so but The pleadings, in my view, were ambiguous, but they don't flatly say that any money was taken away for the current school year in which this incident occurred.
For the precise reason because that it was not, Your Honor. And ultimately, again, the issue on due process is one that lies only against the individual defendants, which means that if qualified immunity disposes of those claims, then there is no longer an argument for the district court to even hold a trial on the issue. It's as this court well knows, qualified immunity is an immunity against suit. I did want to briefly address the Title IX issues, Your Honors, because I do think that they are also important here. Iqbal is controlling. Doe versus Columbia obviously did not overrule Iqbal. Let's bear in mind that Title IX is an intentional discrimination statute. In order for them to prevail, they have to allege specific facts that raise a plausible allegation that Mr. Weintraub, when he made the decision in the administrative conference, was infected by intentional bias. That is the argument that was made by the plaintiffs in Iqbal, who said in the wake of the 9/11 terrorist attacks that when the federal government rounded up Arab Muslim men for detention, that they were discriminated against Arab Muslim men. That's largely the argument they're making here. And what the Supreme Court said is, you can't just show us the numbers. You've got to show us some specific facts from which one can infer the malicious intent by the government actors here. That is something they failed to do after four bites at the apple. They have conclusory factual allegations that do mimic what is in the Doe case, but they don't have specific facts that show that Mr. Weintraub, the decision maker, or that the facts that are found within the Youssef case, statements by the decision maker, statements by other pertinent government officials, or a pattern of decision making that shows gender bias. They have shown none of that, Your Honors, and therefore they are not entitled to a fifth bite at the apple in front of the district court.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The lawyers on this side of the table have 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just a couple of mentions. In terms of property interest, there's the Haygood case. It's a Ninth Circuit case in 1984 that assumes a scholarship is a property interest. And it's in our brief.
So, counsel, again, not focusing on the renewable portion, but on the quarter that these athletes were working on at the time, what is the status of the record? Were they allowed to finish their classes? What do we know about that?
Well, we I don't know if they were allowed to finish their classes, but we included the contract for the scholarships, the $40,000 a year.
Yes, I'm aware of that. I'm just trying to figure out.
Yeah, so I'm not sure what.
I'm trying to figure out whether they got the benefit of that current term, and I don't see that.
Oh, I see. I think they were paid in advance, is what I understand.
And no money is alleged to have been recouped from them, correct?
Right. That's correct.
And they, in terms of being a student in good standing under the contract, by the time that determination was made, basically the school year was over, right?
The what was over?
The school year.
School year, yes. But in terms of, like, if you compare it to Stratton, we don't know the contract that Stratton had for his medical residency. We can assume that there was some similarly morals clause. If you do something that violates the student conduct, you're going to lose your term to be a medical resident. But we don't have that because we have not been able to discover that. And again, we're at the stage of the proceedings where we need to engage in discovery to answer a lot of these broad questions.
What do we need? Let's step back to see what we need to answer on the pleadings. The question is, we've got the contract, which we can read, and it's pretty short. Actually, I was surprised.
Yeah, I know.
Who knew that these athletic contracts?
But again, we don't know what the medical residency contract is for Stratton.
No, but the question here, as I think Judge Kristen has been pointing out, there's the contract for that school year in which they were in, and then there's, of course, the renewability. So is there anywhere in your complaint that you've alleged that they were deprived of anything under the contract for the school year they were in?
No, and I take exception to the word renewability, because the presumption is that they would continue.
Continuation, we'll call it.
They did not have to reapply every year.
Understand.
And we don't know how similar or dissimilar that condition is from the medical residency in Stratton, for example.
Thank you, counsel.
Okay.
We appreciate very much the arguments of all three counsel. They've been very interesting and helpful in this challenging case, and the case is submitted. Our final case on this morning's docket is Informing Citizens versus the FAA.